Hello, this is The Thing About Cars, and this is Mickey Desai coming at you from Atlanta, Georgia, surrounded around the table by some old friends and some of our usual friends. Dawn, are you there?
I am here.
Becca?
I'm here.
Ben?
I'm here.
Excellent. Dave?
Signing in as one of the unusual friends. I'm here.
And the one, the only, coming back to The Thing About Cars table after a while off, has Greg. Greg, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. Glad to be here. Thanks.
I'm glad to hear you again. Hope everything's doing all right with you.
No, not too bad.
Yeah.
Life's good. We're still standing up and carrying on.
Pandemic being what it is, of course.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But of course.
Of course. So let's start with our grand trivia auto question for the day. I actually have two questions, which you'll see why I picked these two questions. The first question is, this sporty offering was produced in response to Chevy's introduction of the Corvette 2 years earlier. This model spawned the personal luxury car niche upon introduction in 1955. Was that car the Thunderbird, the Oldsmobile 98, the Buick Wildcat, or the Pontiac Grand Prix? And let's go ahead and answer this one right now, because I think it has something to do with the way the show may unfold.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I know what I think it is.
Well, go for it, Becca. What do you think it is?
Is it unfair for the Ford person to go first? No. I think it's the Thunderbird.
Yeah? Does anyone else have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I'll have to agree with her. I think it's Thunderbird, too.
Definitely.
Yeah, she's right. The Thunderbird was released in 1955 in response to Chevy's introduction of the Corvette. So well done, Becca.
Can I make a comment on it?
Sure.
The reason being that for a long time, Chevy and Ford had a tit for tat kind of thing in responses to, you know, one company would release a car and the other company would have something very similar. And I don't know if you want this to be trivia or for me to say, what the Mustang was actually competing with.
I have a guess.
What's your guess?
Camaro.
Camaro came out after the Mustang.
Oh, then what?
The Camaro was released in response to the Mustang.
Oh.
The Mustang.
Was it that Olds?
I'm sorry?
Was it the Olds? The Oldsmobile?
No, it's Chevy and Ford.
Oh, Chevy. Okay.
But it was the Corvair.
The Corvair.
Yeah. Very good. All right. So the actual formal grand trivia auto question for this episode is, you guys ready?
Ready.
Oh, yeah.
Hit me.
The 1955. the 1955 to 1957 Ford Thunderbird coupes were noted for what distinctive styling feature? Ooh. Did they have side exhausts? Did they have quad headlights? Did they have round opera windows? Or did they have padded leather roofs? Shall I repeat those?
No.
Yes.
I hear yes. So the 55 to 57 Thunderbird coupes were noted for what distinctive styling feature? Were they padded leather roofs? Were they round opera windows? Were they quad headlights? Or were they side exhaust ports? So that's our grand trivia auto question for this episode. Yeah, Becca.
And hint, people that are enthusiasts might know this feature by a different name.
Right.
Okay. You know what I mean, don't you, Greg?
Yeah, I do, Becca.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So if you're scratching your head, think of different names for what he said.
Right. So our first segment for the day is Cultural Collision. Our one and only Dave is going to bring us. What are you going to bring us, Dave?
Well, I thought actually the Thunderbird came up last week as well. So I thought we would spend some time talking about the role of the Thunderbird in especially American culture. One of the reason I was dealing with it is when the Thunderbird came up last week and during the show, it was a triggering episode for me, because when I was 3 years old, I managed to get my head caught in the power windows of my mother's 68 Thunderbird.
Oh, goodness.
My mom was this very proper, buttoned up, really cultivated an English sense of demeanor until she got behind the wheel of her car, and then she drove like a bat out of hell. And I was about 3 years old and I was in the back seat, and she decided the wind was messing up her perm, so she put it up the window and it wedged my head between the top of the window and the top of the car.
I've seen that happen to so many kids, though. You'd be surprised. I see it all the time.
In my case, you know, my mom was not the best with machinery under pressure, so she just kept punching the up button.
Oh no.
Oh. That'll get him unstuck.
So anyway, to help me deal with the emotional baggage, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the Thunderbird, because like Becca, I'm a real big fan of a lot of Ford cars. I'm not a fan necessarily of Ford as a company business, especially when it comes to business strategy, because Ford has the ability to create incredible iconic brands and then manage them into niches and applications that one really seemed to ask for. And I'm looking at you, Mustang Mach-E. But so Ford's, as you mentioned, Mickey, Ford came out with the Thunderbird as a reaction to the Corvette, but it was not, they didn't market it the same way. So the original idea for it came when Henry Ford II was at the Paris Auto Show and was looking at Fiats and MGs and Triumphs and said, why can't we have something like that? And his vice president of production called Detroit and said, have drawings for us to look at when we get back from Paris. But yeah, this idea of positioning the car as a personal car, a personal luxury car, was unique at the time. And so much of that car, especially the first three or four generations, really kind of set design for cars. It wasn't until the mid 70s when all of a sudden they said, hey, let's try turning it into a sedan and all of a sudden it became virtually identical with the Ford LTD, another luxurious car of my history.
Yeah, I have often played the mental what if game, imagining how things would have gone if the Thunderbird had kept up with the Corvette. What kind of amazing sporty Thunderbirds might we have had through history?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Even just the original track it was on, what consumer was left out that couldn't get the Corvette. It was started out great.
And one of the things that I thought that was great about distinguishing it, it wasn't necessarily as high performance as sports cars would be, but it was a hell of a lot of fun to drive. And that idea of building something that is fun and stylish, spoke to a lot of people. It's fun and stylish, but I also, like the Corvair, I'm not worried about it flipping on a tight curve.
It was a beautiful car, and it came in some really interesting colors back then.
Yes.
Then the 70s, oh, yuck. Just yuck.
Yeah, I don't know whose idea that was, but I hope there was some serious karma coming their way.
There's a lot of stuff that I think went culturally wrong in the 70s. It's not just cars, but there's a lot of things that just kind of went sideways in the 70s for reasons that I still don't understand, that I was even alive for them.
Yeah. And so my mother, being this huge car enthusiast, actually had, she wanted the 59 Thunderbird, but because she had 35 children, it was a highly impractical car. But she did have two. She had a fifth generation, which was the 1968 beautiful, sleek, dark gray car. We called it the Gray Ghost. And then at the end of the 70s, they came out with the ninth generation, which became for the longest time one of the preferred body models for NASCAR. But as we were talking about this and just researching it, I'm like, okay, what, so two questions came out. What would make it iconic as a car, and how do we know it's iconic? So when I think about what makes it iconic, it was the fact that it was a hell of a lot of fun to drive, but also was these design aspects, because it was a combination of futuristic design, fun, and freedom, which was actually how a lot of post-World War II Americans saw themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with those lights and the tail fins, the both coming out the back, it's mm-hmm. kind of, it's very fascinating the way that the car looks like a person in the front.
It does, doesn't it?
I mean, it's got those big eyes and the wide mouth and in the grill with the little tiny nose on the emblem.
Which reminds me of a more recent Ford car, actually.
What's that?
Do you remember the generation of the Ford Taurus that was more jelly bean-ish, like around 97? But they tended to look like a scared goldfish.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, so we're looking at this, I'm like, okay, well, you know, was the car, you know, I think the car is iconic, but was it? And so the two things that really jumped out at me was the number of songs and film appearances that you can point to with the Thunderbird. You know, it's, you've got, you know, forget the Fabulous Thunderbirds, but you had, starting in 1959, Black and White Thunderbird was released by the Delicates, and there was basically a song about a Thunderbird released every couple of years through the 60s, only one in the 70s because, as aforementioned, it, you know, went far astray, and then back in the 90s. So it's got this role in music, but more importantly, when you go to IMDb and say, okay, how many references are there? How many times does a Ford Thunderbird appear in a movie or a TV show? There are 98 web pages, each with about 30 documentations on it of the Thunderbird appearing. So it speaks to the country in some like subconscious element.
Oh yeah. It's, I mean, Greece, T-Birds, you know, mm-hmm. you that's the other thing about it. It's got a cute little nickname. I've never even called it the Thunderbird. I always called it T-Bird. My dad always called it a T-Bird.
Yeah, actually, we always called it a T-Bird.
And now I have the Beach Boys in my head. Thank you. Well, and Mustang is very similar. I used to try to keep a list going of the movies and songs and various things. What was that, Ben?
Well, you know, every time I see one, it's not the Beach Boys I think of. What I hear is that bird is a word.
No, yeah. But the thing that I remember about the Thunderbird is when Ford redid the thing for, oh gosh, when was that, Ben, when Halle Berry drove one in
in the James Bond movie. Yeah, that was, yeah. I forget the exact year that came out, but it was around 99, I think. And
exactly. And that model itself was not very well received at all.
No, they did a, well, I think what they did was they did a really great job with the exterior styling. You know, they hit some great retro notes with that, but the rest of the car failed to deliver.
That's
You know, it had, you know, totally uninspiring performance, a very plasticky interior. I think a lot of bits were, you know, escort sourced.
Yeah. Oh, okay. See, I never had the opportunity to drive one, but I thought they had done a really good job with the exterior, and I wasn't sure what the issue was that caused it to flop.
I think it was a combination of, yes, the exterior was gorgeous. I'm like, oh, they're, you know, they're coming back around with design, but the interior, Ben said, it was kind of cheap, and it was for the price point they attempted to market it at.
Right.
You know, that you expect a lot more from a $50,000 car.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. There are some gorgeous concepts. If you look online, plug in almost any recent year before the word Thunderbird, and you'll find, I think these are just things that fans out there have cooked up on their own. You'll find all these really neat looking, you know, cars of what people think a new Thunderbird should look like. There's some that are, you know, kind of a two-door fastback kind of thing with that sort of same front end design that Ford's been sort of running with lately.
And before the car, does anybody know what Thunderbird was?
Yeah, it's an element of Native American culture, American Indian culture.
Yeah, I was going to use the word deity, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's a mythical creature, at least, if not a deified something. Yeah.
Mm. It was also the name of a country club in California that the head of engineering at Ford belonged to.
Oh,
interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that's kind of like, what is the Mustang named after? It's not named after the horse. Yeah, so it's a more modern reference than. So it's entirely possible.
Oh, by the way, my dad had a 63 T-Bird.
Oh.
Ah.
and a two-door with the chestnut and the chestnut interior. That was his first, that was his first brand new car. And nice. It was a nice car.
And my my father always believed in selling cars. You know, he basically would pay off a car for 4 years and then sell it and buy a new one. And my mother was devastated when he sold the Thunderbird. But in my case, my daddy actually did take the T-Bird away.
See, my dad was like that. Every 2 years, he was flipping cars. And my poor mother, it just, anybody ever tries to touch my cars,
No, nope, I keep cars for a really long time.
Yeah, they'll find your body if you touch my car.
Dave, thank you. That was an excellent cultural collision. Is there anything else we need to wrap up with about Ford Thunderbirds before we move on to the next segment?
No, I think that covers it. I would like to point out this is the second show in a row, though, that we referred to Becca and a body.
Ooh. Well,
it's Halloween.
It is exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I make no admissions while anything is recording.
It's too late, Becca. The word is out.
Dave, one last question. Do we know how many are still in circulation all these years later from 55?
Yes. I saw a stat of that because of the very earliest years. First of all, it sold so much better than I expected. They expected in 1955 when they were only going to make 10,000. And the day they announced at the Detroit Motor Show, by the end of the show, they had sold like 3,500. So they wound up making, I think, 14,000, 15,000 of the first generation, and then like more than 200,000 of the second generation.
It was on a course similar to the Mustang. If they had just found a way to keep it going forward like they did later, it could have done so much more.
Yeah. But that is one of the things. I don't actually have an exact number for you, Don, but people have prized these things and you know, preserved them and hid them. So the one reference I saw, I think like maybe 2,200 of the first generation are still out there.
Oh, that's pretty good. Which means their price point, if somebody wanted to be a collector, the price point wouldn't be as high.
No. So, not counting the one that Thelma and Louise drove off the cliff.
Greg, how are you doing?
Great.
It's been a long time since we've had a chance to catch up. I thought this would be a good excuse to do exactly that.
We haven't done any car shows.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. We were working to try to put together a monthly cruise in the inside the perimeter on the north part of town before all this started, and that's all been put on the back burner, obviously.
Sure.
But I think the collectors, when we do a show, everybody's more than 6 feet apart, and I just think it's time to start, dusting off the cars and get back out there. It's just that we're going to wait till next year, wait for the weather to change.
Yep.
It's just too spooky.
It is too spooky.
we'll use the October word this time. It's spooky.
Well, and I think there's nothing wrong with erring on the side of safety, right? It's one of those things that the consequences can be are probably not worth it. So
especially when your insurance tells you we're not covering you. We pay $500 a year liability insurance.
Yeah.
And they basically said, no.
Yeah.
Don't even think about it. So I did actually see a cruise 2 weekends ago in Chamblee. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be more the exotics and the high powered stuff, and they had Chamblee police and everything over there. So I'm not exactly sure what was going on. I was in the middle of changing lights in my Z, so I didn't get a chance to track it down. But people are doing some things, and it's just, I think we'll start again in March. We've got something lined up in March in Brookhaven. I think that'll be our kickoff again.
Yeah. Awesome. I've seen something happen up in Woodstock, but I suspect that they're not an organized entity that puts on the show. I don't think they have a body that actually buys liability insurance the way you
do. Yeah. So that's a problem.
Yeah.
For me, I've just been working in the garage a little bit, with business being down so much. Mm-hmm. I don't have any money to spend on the vehicles. So I do what I can do for free and just ignore the rest of it.
Well, and I was going to say, let's remind folks what it is that you do.
oh, I have a promotional products company and a screen print company, and I've lost obviously most events. Mm-hmm. And the problem in my schools, the problem is a lot of my teachers have decided to retire in this. Oh. So, you know, I didn't just lose business. I've lost my contacts.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's going to be crazy when it kicks back off again.
Yeah.
Because I'm starting like I did 20 years ago. So it is what it is.
Right.
I should have retired 2 years ago. I hate when I miss an opportunity. Well, but anyway, you know, main thing is we're healthy, right?
Exactly.
For all of us.
Exactly. You know? So are you getting your classic car out of the garage at all during this time?
No, right now it's got too much stuff behind. I got other projects. Somebody gave me their wood chippers. Somebody gave me a couple cultivators that need to be fixed. So right now everything's on hold until I get all the other little projects that have nothing to do with cars out of the way.
I get that. I just didn't know if you took it out to breathe every once in a while.
I want to. I just can't, you know, I have to move, you know, 5 feet of junk to get to it. It needs to. I'll probably get it out next week or two. So it'll be good.
And let's remind our audience exactly what that car is.
Yeah, I've got a 1938 Plymouth, two-door sedan, basically all stock. And it's what I did in high school. It's my high school car. Mm-hmm. And of course, like everybody keeps their high school car.
I wish.
Yeah, I wish too.
Yeah. And then doing a lot of work on the kit car early on in this. And then after a while, I realized that I'm just bored of doing that too. So the kit sits there. It's closer. I got the motor out and it's ready to be rebuilt, sitting in the warehouse. So I'm going to start working on that this winter.
Very cool.
So we'll see what happens. Maybe next spring.
I don't know if you've seen any of it, but Ben's Lotus is actually up and running.
No, I have not seen it, but that's good to hear.
Yeah, I think I should probably have it able to come to your thing in March.
Sweet.
Yeah, that'll be cool. So, Greg,
let me say one more thing.
Sure.
Dave, you did a great job on the T-Birds. I need to make sure that the T-Bird Club here in Atlanta gets to this podcast when it's ready. There's a lot of guys out there. I think they'd like to hear some of that history that you had put down. So,
hey, thanks, Greg. It was fun. Yeah. Hopefully they won't be turned off by, you know, the traumatic elements involving my mother.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did wonder why you don't have video. And now I think I know why.
That's great.
It All was right. just too much. So,
Greg, one of the things we're fooling around with this new format of the show is we want to ask our guests the same standardized question set so we can learn a little bit more about them and just have a little more fun with some of these answers.
All right, go.
So question number one for you is, if what is your dream car?
Well, would it be real tacky if I said my kit car?
No. Your dream is your dream. You don't have to justify
it. I would love to see it roll out of my garage one of these days.
Yeah.
It's been in there a long time. It's got roots that are probably 10 feet thick already.
Well, what is it?
Yeah.
It's an Avenger GT12. Looks like Ford GT40.
Nice. And
I'm building a 2.1 liter motor, Volkswagen motor for it.
Wow.
With dual carb. So, you know, it should scoot along a little bit. Right. But it's just the style. I'm hoping I can get it done so I can still get in and out of it.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I drive a 350Z now. I just always have enjoyed sports cars, raced sports cars, worked on them. So it's just where my head's at.
Isn't there a new Z car coming out soon?
I believe it's going to be a 4 liter. So it'll be a 40, which gives them, I guess it'll be a Z40.
Okay.
So that's going to be kind of cool. I've seen some artist illustrations of it and some of those smuggled out pictures. It looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
I hope they do a better job with headlights than they did on this one, because it was a 5.5 hour job to change the light bulbs in the front.
Oh, jeez.
Are you serious?
Pull the wheel liners out. Technically, if you're going to do anything more than change the bulbs, you pull the front bumper out because the four bolts are hidden under the front bumper. Mm-hmm. As an engineer, I want to say, what were you thinking?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
So, it was a 5.5 hour job.
I've heard the modern Volkswagen Beetles, in order to change the bulb, you had to take it to the dealership because there's no way to actually get to it.
Yeah, probably very similar. You know,
stupid as that, you would never build a house that way.
Right.
You think?
Why would you do that with a car? I just don't.
Marketing. It's marketing. It's all about marketing. We don't want anything visible on the front. So therefore.
Right. And we want you to pay us $60 to change a light bulb instead of. Yeah.
Bingo.
Yeah. Right.
All right, Greg. Question number two. Where is your next road trip?
Forced road trip might be Denver, Colorado at Christmas.
Oh, very cool.
Girls both live out there now, so that's what we do at Christmas time.
Excellent.
But as a fun, strictly a fun one, will be Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
Oh man,
I really want to do that.
Yeah, me too. Actually, I'm not even hugely into bourbon. I just want to get up there and do it.
Yeah, it's just fun. Yeah. The problem is the expense.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the expense of the trip, it's the expense of the bourbon.
Yeah.
I stopped at Jack Daniels at Christmas time coming back from Denver. I dropped $200 in a heartbeat. You know, I was like, gee.
Well, the only one I've been to is Woodford Reserve. That was a really nice place to visit. But my brother has done the whole trail and he enjoyed it.
Yep.
Yeah. It's my wife doesn't drink, so there's my designated driver.
Right.
It would just be fun. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yes.
So question
number three, what is the weirdest thing you've seen in someone's house or garage?
Oh, gee.
So you added house to it. That could add so many other elements.
You know, if we say garage, then, you know, the weirdest thing might be a pink jack stand or something, or, you know.
No, you can see some pretty weird stuff in garages.
Yeah, but, you know, or Ben's foot sticking out from underneath
When you sent me that the other day, I kind of just drew a blank. I just can't think of anything that I considered weird.
Well, that's why I added house, because even I'm sitting there. Exactly. It's like, what is weird? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, now if I, you know, maybe, I don't know.
That's all right. That's all right. Yeah. If nothing stands out to you, it doesn't.
No, nothing. Nothing's weird to me in a garage.
Right on.
I'm weird enough as it is.
The last question, does pineapple belong on a pizza, Greg? Mm-hmm.
No.
Greg is shaking his head.
Thank you.
No.
Thank you.
My Italian relatives are rolling over in their graves even hearing that. No.
But come on. Now, I mean,
pineapple only belongs in Hawaii in drinks.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Greg. Excellent answers.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. And I'm glad we could do this again today. It's been too long since we've seen you.
Yeah, well.
So
it's fun, you know, it's always fun. And, you know, I do have an opinion every once in a while. So,
yeah, exactly. Let's move on to our next segment. That would be Ben Takes a Moment, where Ben gets to wax philosophically about things. Ben, what have you got?
Well, you know, Halloween is coming up. It's about a week away as of when we're sitting down and having this conversation. And the fact that the dead bodies in Becca's cars came up.
No, they just transport them.
Right. Well, that really was a really excellent coincidence, because being the Halloween season, my favorite holiday, by the way, but being the Halloween season, I figured I'd take a moment to talk about hearses.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. These big long cars that you haul corpses in.
Don't you laugh if a hearse goes by, because you may be the next to die. Sorry. Yes. Yeah.
Right. It's kind of a weird car when you think about it. You know, they're big, they're expensive, they're purpose built just to make short trips with dead bodies in them. And I got to thinking, I said, well, why do they even call it a hearse? The origin of that is kind of weird. The term comes via French from originally the Latin word herpex, which was the term for an agricultural implement, the same thing that we know today as a harrow, you know, a thing that just kind of breaks up and smooths out the ground, you know, not as coarse as plowing. And the reason for that was because in the early days of European funerals, somebody came up with a thing that holds up the pall, or like a fabric covering over the casket, or just wooden box as they were in those days, that had some little spikes on it to hold some candles too. Somebody thought that looked like a herpex, and so they started calling it that. And then eventually this kind of hardware wound up on the horse carts that, once wheels became popular, that carried the bodies. And then the term just kind of stuck around, and there you have it. But yeah, I mean, the idea of a, you know, custom coach for hauling the dead goes back before cars, of course. I mean, there are some horse-drawn ones out there that still survive. In fact, if you go to the Studebaker National Museum in, can't believe I just drew a blank, up there in Indiana where Studebakers used to be built. At the museum there, there's a horse-drawn Studebaker hearse dating from the 1850s that is beautiful to behold. Motorized ones didn't really start to catch on until into the 20th century. The fact that they're often built out of Cadillacs and Lincolns and things like that had less to do with, you know, treating the dead to a nice ride as much as to the fact that, you know, like in the 1920s, those were the most heavy duty chassis you could get.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the ones where, and you know, in the 50s, they had the ambulance and hearse cars that were kind of the same, more or less the same body, but maybe, you know, only differentiated by a little bit. Of course, in small towns, they actually did do both jobs.
And Ghostbusters, don't forget.
Right. That was I believe that one was called a Miller Meteor, made by the Miller Company. Yeah. Very collectible now, thanks to the movie. But
it's Miller time.
Those combination hearse ambulances went away in the 70s, mostly due to DOT regulations. Just for, you know, heavy duty features for ambulances and such. But it's a really interesting category of cars. They do have their fans. They've got a following. They can be lots of fun. All kinds of great stories. I heard about a guy who bought one once hundreds of miles from where he lived and was driving it home, stopped in a rest area somewhere and lay down and back to take a nap. And he had the
see where this is going.
It gets better than that. Yeah, he had the door propped open because it was a warm day. Well, the wind came up, blew the door shut, and he was trapped. Because think about it, there's no reason to put a door handle on the inside. And so he's
pry the inner panel off.
It's all steel.
Yeah, Becca, you can't. Yeah,
the inner panel.
Yeah.
See, I ran into that with the Jeep, but you just pry off the plastic panel, and you have access to the. Okay, so go ahead.
So he's beating on the back window, trying to get the attention of anybody out there walking by. Of course, these people are hearing thumping coming from a hearse, and they're not approaching. You know?
I would be all over that. Hello?
Yeah, somebody did eventually let him out. And I know a guy here in the Atlanta area who he sold it a few years ago, but for several years he had a 1967 Ford hearse. And this is where a little bit more interesting little terminology comes out. There's more than one type. All cars that carry the dead are not created equally. You have the fancy ones for the funerals, but then you've got the plain ones that are often referred to as removal cars. These are just the ones that pick up the bodies from the hospital, the nursing home, wherever, take them to the funeral home. And they're usually pretty plain, and that's what this one was. It was that pickle green color that so many 60s Fords were. They had painted over the long side windows and stuck little, you know, cheap Landau bars on there. And the rear seat was folded down, not removed, but folded down. And the casket table placed on top in there, not even screwed down, I don't think. And the guy had, you know, magazine ads from, you know, funeral trade publications for this very model of this car, framed and hanging in his garage. He was very proud of it. He even had little magnetic funeral flags to stick on the front fenders. And he would have a lot of fun with it. Of course, being a working car, it had no radio, no air conditioning, you know, rubber floor mats, but it was fun to drive around. I rode in it with him once, and he had a lot of fun with it. One Halloween, he parked it in his front lawn, you know, where the kids would have to walk past it to get to the door of the house. And he put a fog machine inside it. And he, you know, dribbled some fake blood from the, you know, the windowsills down the doors. Had it all set up, and this little six-year-old girl, just precious as can be, walks up to the door, does the whole trick-or-treat thing, thanks him for the candy. She walks away, looks at the car, looks back at him, and says, "That's not real blood." He was totally owned by this six-year-old. and you know how a lot of hearses have that little chromed nameplate in the side window that tells what funeral home they're from? He was going to get some of those made that would say Morningwood. But his wife vetoed that.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. But
to be too morbid about it, but you know, when my father passed away, the vehicle that came to get him from the house was simply a white panel van.
Yeah, Yeah, plain unmarked vans often do the job for, you know, removal.
That was the day when I realized that the term undertaker had been replaced with funeral director.
Right. It's probably been around a while, but yeah. And then, so you've got those two classes of cars. You've also got the flower cars. If you ever see a 50s Cadillac that looks like somebody's converted into an El Camino, there's a good possibility that it was a flower car. They're these open Cadillacs that would carry all the flowers and wreaths and everything to the cemetery. Right. It's fascinating cars. And with all the fans and enthusiasm that they generate, I have found that there are, in fact, a couple of clubs. The big national the big national one is called the Professional Car Society. And it's not strictly hearses. It also includes ambulances and limos and things, but lots of hearse enthusiasts. But then there's one here in the Atlanta area that's a little more laid back, a little more enthusiast oriented, not so persnickety about perfection, called the Dead Ends. And in fact, a friend of mine who used to have the Ford one came up with that name for this group.
That's too funny.
You could check out their Facebook page. There are a lot of cool pictures of, you know, things. There's, I think the picture at the top right now is a white Cadillac hearse with blue flames painted on it.
Oh, man, that was so cool.
Yeah. People have a lot of fun with these cars. I've often thought it'd be cool to have one, you know, horrible MPG, but they'd still be fun to have.
Back in the late 90s, I almost bought I can't remember what era Cadillac hearse. The only reason I wanted it, we were going to do like this not cannonball run kind of thing. They called it a cornball run or something. But that thing had a 500 cubic inch engine in it.
Yeah.
And I desperately wanted this car just so I could play with that engine and see what I could do with it. But,
you had had fun. Yeah. I've also seen, bands use them to haul their gear occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They do tend to last a long time because they don't get a lot of miles put on them.
Right.
There was also the gumball.
Oh yeah.
As far as the runs.
I remember the movie. Yeah. Gumball Rally.
So maybe we should get a hearse and restore it.
Hey, that'd be fun. Could do all kinds of crazy things with it.
If you remember the news going around of people dressing up like clowns and attacking people, and they were calling them the killer clowns.
Huh.
I dressed up the Mustang a few years ago. I put fake blood all over the front, the hood, even the bloody handprint, making it look like someone slid off. And then I attached a clown wig into the grill, like it got stuck, and done this whole post about, you know, killer clowns, don't worry, I got your back. Like I'm running over the killer clowns.
Oh, well.
Oh, there was something else that you guys reminded me of. Not clowns, not hearses. Oh, I knew a guy, speaking of picking up bodies, that apparently it wasn't always done in something like an ambulance or a station wagon. This guy I used to work with, who is now a lawyer, he said that when he was a teenager, he would go pick up bodies in a regular old sedan, and he would go get fast food on the way back to the funeral parlor, and people in the fast food drive-thrus would be shocked to see a dead body sitting in the seat next to him. And,
oh, boy.
So I don't know if this is true or not. I don't know if any of this was legal, but this is the story that this gentleman told.
I'm not going to go into anything too graphic on this particular podcast, but lots of things have me asking if he could really do that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. From a practical standpoint, it doesn't seem that workable.
Yeah. But to me, it's like, okay, does he get to drive in the HOV lane?
That's a very good question. Yeah.
They say it has to be a human. They don't say it has to be alive. I don't know. Just wondering.
Well, there was a case, and we're going to, this is probably not where we should take this conversation, but there was a case where a pregnant woman used that same argument.
I've heard that.
You should be allowed to go in the HOV lane. And I have no idea what was the legal outcome of this case. So, but anyway. So, well, thank you, Ben. Excellent stuff on hearses. What do you guys say about doing a couple of items of listener/viewer mail?
Okay.
Bring it on.
I've got a couple of questions. The first one is, someone asks, when replacing a car battery, does it matter which car cable is connected to the positive side? And I think, they mean in the absence of any color coding. And of course the answer is still yes, but yeah, Becca has, I think, been sitting on top of this visceral reaction for a while now.
Yes. And even if there's no color coding, if you look, you're still going to see positive and negative symbols on various things.
On the battery, yes. Not necessarily the cables.
Not necessarily, but I would think that if a, I don't know, colorblind person was in charge of the battery cables on the assembly line, that they would find some way to make sure they were marked.
Well, the easiest thing to do, I would think, would be to follow which cable actually attaches itself to the frame. Usually that's not a very long distance. Usually it, you know, it comes right off the battery and it hits the body somewhere.
Better yet, if you've got a you know, an ohm meter, this way you don't have to crawl under anything or poke through something. Just you know, ohm out that cable, take your probe, put it on one cable, touch it to an exposed piece of body or chassis metal, and if you don't read any continuity, try the other cable.
I would think if somebody had an ohm meter or a multimeter, that they would know which cable was which.
They might. They might.
I'm just saying, if you've gone that far in life, you know.
If it's their first time messing with a project car that's really old and decrepit and only has black cables in it and didn't come with a battery in it, and you still may be able to tell, but maybe not. You never know. There's a lot of weird stuff out there, especially one that some previous owner has tampered with.
I feel like there should be this hint, right? So if we have somebody who doesn't know much about batteries or cars, that they should be able to hold the battery in with one finger on the positive terminal, and then they should put their tongue on the ground. And I don't think that's very good advice, though, probably. Yeah.
Speaking on behalf of our attorneys, we are going to say that you know, the thing about cars does not endorse licking your battery.
Much like eating Tide Pods, don't do this at home.
Or touching it anywhere.
Now, some of the batteries do have different size posts.
Some.
And if the cables are stock cables, they should be appropriately sized to the terminals on the battery.
That's cool. I didn't know that. I don't think I've ever seen
it's not like an inch bigger, but it's like an eighth of an inch bigger.
Of course, the other side of that, though, is no matter how much you try to idiot proof something, they're always going to build a better idiot. You know, you will have somebody who will find that one that doesn't quite fit and will then try to hammer it on.
Right.
Yeah.
My dad.
So the short answer to that question is definitely the polarity does matter. It does matter which car cable is connected to which specific terminal on the battery. So
yes, there's a thing called reversing polarity. Yeah.
And I guess we ought to also include the age of the vehicle.
Yes.
Oh, yes, because it matters a lot more on newer ones.
Oh, yeah. Well, the newer ones are going to be negative ground, and you could find old cars that have positive ground.
Yeah, especially British ones. But yeah, with fairly old cars, it's not going to hurt much if you misconnect them. You'll just turn the starter backwards and probably nothing else will happen. But on newer cars, you know, they may have protection built in, but if not, you may fry something.
Yeah, chances are you're going to fry the diodes or whatever in the alternator.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So excellent question. The second question, if we have a little bit more time for it, is this person writes in, they say they're in the proximity of the West Coast fires, and there's a lot of wildfire activity happening out there right now.
Yeah.
I saw some frightening pictures coming in from near Boulder the other day. In any case, the question is, should I change my air filters when it's all done? And I think the answer is yes. What do you guys think?
It's exposed, yeah.
Well, it certainly can't hurt to change it. You know, at least open the thing up and take a look at it. It may be stained gray from the smoke. Now, whether it's catching any extra amount of particulate is open to debate, but if you feel the need to change it, then do it. They're not expensive, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing I was going to say. Greg, you're about to add before
I was going to say it definitely makes sense, because chances are the smoke particles are going to be much finer than dust and dirt.
Yeah,
and chances are you're not really going to see them that much in the filter, they're probably going to be buried in there, and you're really choking the engine without knowing.
Although that made me ponder, for people running a oiled filter, would that be picking up, would that be picking up more of the finer particles?
Probably not.
Probably not.
You don't think so?
No, oiled filters are not very good filters.
No, but they are sticky. You know what I mean.
Yeah, but they've still got more and bigger holes in them.
Yeah, Ben is not a fan.
Trying not to make jokes.
Ben is not a fan of the K&N filter phenomenon or any of their competitors. He's got a good point too. I mean, we've talked about this before, right, Ben?
Yes.
Yeah, the way you increase performance, if you want to decrease restriction on your intake, which gives you an increase in performance, the way to decrease that restriction is to not have as much stuff slowing down the air, which means bigger holes.
Exactly.
Not as much filter media.
Y'all keep opening the way for all these jokes, and I'm trying so hard to be good.
Do we need to talk about holes, Becca?
Becca is in touch with her inner 14-year-old boy.
This is
I'm
true.
In touch with something.
I'm not going there, man.
But you know, if we're changing air filters, since it is the autumn, be sure to use one of those nice pumpkin spice air filters.
Ooh, and then your whole car could smell like pumpkin spice. Ooh.
All right. On that note, let's wrap the show and answer our Grand Trivia Auto question, which I think you guys must know already anyway. I mean, the question was, the 1955 to 57 Ford Thunderbird coupes were noted for what distinctive styling feature? Was it a padded leather roof? Was it side exhausts? Was it a round opera window? Or was it quad headlights? Becca and Greg, I think, already know it. So let's go to Dawn first.
I think it's those round upper windows on the...
Yeah?
Yeah, round upper windows.
Ben?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Dave?
I think the round opera windows were on the second generation of T-Bird.
Mm.
So, I see you, Greg.
I see Greg Lee. So I think it's,
you know, that's a good point. Was the first generation solid back and the second generation had the opera windows?
But didn't Mickey state specific years?
Yes. And the first generation would be the 55 to 57.
Yeah.
So I think it
brought out the opera windows.
Yeah, I think it's the quad headlights.
Dave thinks it's the quad headlights. Greg, finally, Greg and Becca, you sounded like you're on the same page, which is why I'm putting you two together.
Yeah.
Well, he ponders.
I don't remember quad headlights on that. No, I'm sorry. I still remember a single headlight. Am I wrong?
Me too. Now I'm sticking with the windows.
Okay.
Although they are known as porthole windows. With a lot of people.
Okay. Well,
what were the other two choices, Mickey?
The other choices are side exhausts, quad headlights, padded leather roofs.
Have you ever seen one with side exhaust that wasn't done by a person?
No, I never have.
I've never seen
one that was done by an alien.
I mean, as opposed to from factory.
And the Landau roof came out in the 60s.
Yes.
So that eliminates the leather. Oh, man.
Well, the answer is, Greg, you want to
get one?
Yeah. Okay.
Go.
The answer is, it is the round opera windows, the porthole windows. That was the distinctive styling feature that came out on the 55 to 57 model Thunderbird. Yeah. So good job, you guys.
Well, it makes sense because when they brought out the remake back, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago, that was the first thing that I noticed.
Yeah.
I just looked this up.
Baby bird. Right. As the T-Bird Club calls it, a baby bird.
Right.
But that was about the only thing that was good on that car.
Well, I've just looked this up, and what I have found here is that these little windows actually started on the 56 model year. So it was that first generation. They were a no-cost option for 1956 as a way of increasing or improving the rear visibility, or rear quarter visibility.
And was that a removable hardtop?
Yes.
Yes.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Thing About Cars. Anybody have any last minute bits of wisdom or trivia or anything else before we sign off? Yeah, it was good to see you, Greg. Thanks for joining us.
Good to see you here.
Look forward to doing this again the next time. Do a little more.
Anytime, guys.
Yeah. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it when you leave us reviews on wherever it is you find the podcast. Those reviews means more people will find us. And in fact, we're trying to get featured on Apple Podcasts. And the only thing we seem to be missing is more reviews. So please encourage your friends and family members and other car people to check out the podcast. And if you like us and you feel like leaving us a good review, we really appreciate it in our quest to get recognized by Apple. We've been doing this for going on 4 years, according to Ben. We've never really pushed the marketing agenda that hard. So we think maybe it's time to ask to see if people can actually more proactively help us get a little bit more of a headline and see where we can take the show. Thank you, as always, for being part of the Thing About Cars family. And we will see you again with another episode in about a week. Take care.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.